Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay. And it's the dog days of summer, which means that it's climate disaster season. Our guest today, Hillary Brown, who we'll hear from momentarily, is here to talk a bit about the impending threats of climate change to cities. But I should note that at the end of July, as we record this, I'm currently in one of the most polluted cities on Earth here in Montreal, thanks to wildfire smoke. And of course, the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina approaches in less than a month. So with that, with thinking about a new impending season of climate disasters, our guest today is Hillary Brown. She is the Professor Emerita of Architecture at the Spitzer School of Architecture at the City College of New York, and she is the author of a new book, Revitalize, Resettle, How Main Street USA Can Offer New Beginnings for America's Climate Displaced. And very excited to have Hillary on. I think listeners know that, you know, climate migration is an obsession of mine, at least. But Hillary has not just proposed questions and challenges, but really highlights communities that are finding solutions. So Hillary, thank you for joining us.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, not to talk over you there at the beginning here, but if you could unpack Revitalize, Resettle, and particularly how you see yourself in relation to the climate migration and the managed retreat discussions that swirl around, particularly at this time of year. What was your particular approach and how did you identify these communities?
Yeah, well, let me just give an overview quickly. You know, I think that it's fair to say that we're in the face of accelerating climate change and displacement, both coastal and inland. And so the book describes one win-win opportunity to be found by resettling many of those dislodged in small cities and towns, places that constitute really an alternative to overstressing cities, and in an effort to help also importantly revitalize rural communities. So I have a background in climate change, but I have been particularly despairing of how we have largely failed those small towns of America, given our long-term political and economic focus on metropolitan areas. This is, in effect, really decimated the population and economies of many American small towns. And these are places, I believe, of social and cultural value. And I think that we should look for opportunities to help them out. So I look ahead to an increasingly destabilized climate, which will, in all likelihood, put millions of us at risk before the end of the century. Approximately a meter of sea level rise by 2100, according to scientists, will put about 4 million at risk, but a more likely estimate of 1.8 meters would put 13 million at risk of inundation. And these numbers don't include riverine flooding inland, excessive urban heat and wildfires. And I would say that it's America's low-income and BIPOC communities that are going to bear a disproportionate share of the damage from these and other extreme weather events. So I start the book by talking about how at the moment, in the last decade, we've been moving to all the wrong places. We're finding that there's been great mobility to Phoenix, to Dallas and Houston, Atlanta, and in particular Florida, many cities in Florida. And it just shows that we have a kind of numbness or ignorance about climate change. And I hope the book dispels that. And so the book that really emphasizes all the displaced cannot be accommodated in the cities that have been named as climate havens, for example, Duluth, Minnesota, or Buffalo and Syracuse, New York, Minneapolis, et cetera. These cities would likely bear the brunt of influx and resettlement. There will be new stresses on already maxed out infrastructure and services and competition for jobs. There'll be rising housing costs, and likely in the end, this gentrification is going to force people out. And that will create a second wave of displacement. A figure that one climate expert says could be as high as 25 million.
That is a sobering stat indeed. And yeah, I think it's very telling to your point there that our friend Jesse Keenan at Tulane University, who has his own book coming out this fall, will have him on, who was the one who coined climate proof Duluth in the New York Times, immediately then triggered the mayor of Duluth to basically start pushing back on this. We saw NIMBYism and fears of gentrification immediately play into that. Hillary, I guess there's a question I want to start with there's obviously a crisis of climate change and displacement and a crisis of American small towns. What makes you think these two crises can be solved by solving each other, particularly given American NIMBYism, the current political climate in the United States, which we can obviously discuss how the federal government is, in fact, working against this very agenda. But why do you think small towns will be receptive to climate migrants, and how can that be enshrined as a matter of policy, or how is it actually being managed? How is this happening on the ground?
Well, the book really goes into quite a bit of detail about that. Obviously, not every town is going to be willing or at all receptive to seeing an influx of population. Many towns, however, have over time hemorrhaged population, especially youth who've migrated to cities, and they're losing, employment in forestry and mining, and really undermining the economies of these places. And there's, of course, struggling to maintain their sustainability. So I think that you will find a number of towns, and the book already calls out some, that have taken measures to resecure population. I don't know if you want me to go into examples, but there's one in particular that really shows the initiative of a town in the face of declining population. They opted for redevelopment by creating a 1% tax increase going to development. They also established a leadership academy to retrain young people to be entrepreneurial minded. And the results of this is really quite astonishing. And the other thing that they did is they prepared by renovating and building new housing. And the result was that over time, last decade or so, they received an influx of young people in their 30s. Those are, likely families. The kids will help repopulate the school district. They've seen results from this. And there are other towns that have made significant effort looking at their own resources to lure in new farmers or new ranchers and thereby increase employment and general population.
So there are a few terms of use that come into play in this book that I think we should define, because they do appear frequently, although you haven't used any of them yet. So I can tell that you're used to talking about this book to the unfamiliar. I guess the first one that comes up is climagrant, which is a portmanteau of climate and immigrant. And the others that have come up are rural core and micropolis. And I'd like to hear a little bit about how those three things interplay. I know we're trying to make a distinction between small towns, large towns that have been identified as climate havens already by others, and this idea of a micropolis or a micropolitan settlement. vis-a-vis the climate immigration problem. I'd be interested to hear how that works.
Okay. So what is a climigrant? Climigrant.
It's a naturally flowing portmanteau, yes. But
it is.
Yes.
I think that the term of art is these are people that are dislodged by climate precipitated events, either slow events like sea level rise or hurricane flooding, and they're forced out, either some voluntary and some through managed retreat. And we're going to see lots of those, as I started off by saying, in terms of numbers. So that's one answer. You asked about the rural core and how that's defined in relation to a micropolitan settlement. So the term of art, a micropolitan settlement, is a census category that defines places that are smaller than cities, population between 10 and 50,000. For the purposes of my book, I really look at the rural core as that, you know, main street of a small town, a smaller settlement that's characterized by a concentration of businesses, industry, and infrastructure, and somewhat higher population density. In other words, you see in many small towns apartments above storefronts. And it's that model that I emphasize on the book as the core that should be the center of economic redevelopment as well as expansion through compact redevelopment.
Thank you for that. I know that in some of the research that you cite, there's some really interesting overlapping maps which show counties, it's kind of organized by counties, that would be considered receiver counties. What were the criteria that make these places ideal for climigrants? Why were they identified as places that would be ideal for receiving people who are fleeing climate change?
Well, that's an important question. So there are many web-based tools from FEMA to EPA that look at places of lesser risk from the meteorological perspective. And I fastened on a group of planners and architects because of my background. And they're an organization, not-for-profit, called Place Initiative. And they did a meta-analysis of a whole range of data, you know, including weather and climate and microclimate and risk and somewhat, to somewhat extent, resiliency. And they did this on a county-by-county basis and mapped that. And it effectively shows areas of the country that will be subject to least or lesser amounts of climate change. So using that material as a base, I started to impose other frameworks and other issues. For example, I looked at Princeton's analysis of the places, optimal places across the country for solar and wind. And then I overlaid that map on the places that have been highlighted by Place Initiative as likely places for resettlement, showing that, you know, these are places that have likely more opportunity for energy autonomy and for income, if you will, from wind farms and, you know, solar farms.
That's great. Well, I was wondering, can you further unpack sort of like the stack is, or one way of describing this, given how many examples you have, can you point to sort of like what are the best examples in each small town around the country for what you consider like the essential infrastructure, ranging from food to renewable energy systems to policy measures for welcoming people? Who's doing this right and who's really thinking about it? I'm curious who the heroes are to you in this.
Yeah, well, I highlight a number of really good examples. I already talked about Ord, Nebraska, that undertook those redevelopment initiatives. But there are many others that I'd like to mention. And those include, say, Madison, Indiana, which really emphasized their historic assets and restoration and their investment in hotels and housing helped them create some 270 local businesses over time. So it's that looking at your own resources, basically. In Clinton, Iowa, this is a town where the highway went straight through the town, and of course there was a lot of speeding because it's a state highway. And they created a protective corridor on Main Street by rerouting the traffic. They refurbished a dilapidated industrial area. And they did this, of course, with help from DOT, US DOT. But largely, the transformation of that former industrial area went into mixed use housing and commercial, again, at their own initiative. Another example might be a small town in upstate New York, Mount Morris, that advertised to developers the need for redevelopment strategies for their tiny town. And one very forward-looking developer wound up rehabilitating some 20 Main Street buildings. And he got his return from the rental of the housing above the stores. So I see evidence among these towns of self-help, of a bold vision and initiatives. West Windsor, Vermont is another example, which lost its ski resort not too long ago, and the property values there plummeted. They undertook to buy the ski resort, the community, with NGO support, and over time the housing prices returned and in fact doubled. So again, it's this understanding what your local assets are. Some towns look for building themselves as rural gateways near national parks, and they really build up businesses related to recreation, a lot of those in Minnesota and Oregon. So that just gives you a kind of sampling.
All right, well, if that was a great sampling of hope, then I guess I want to turn this around and ask. Obviously, I assume much of the book was written before last November's federal elections. But obviously, at the United States, at the federal level, now has a government that is, in fact, dismantling the EPA's ability to even regulate climate change. And so it appears that we're going to go through this. I'm curious, the things you just described, you know, of course, this idea of understanding local assets, of mapping local actors, very bottom up. What should the top down look like, or what were you hopeful for if the Biden administration had continued with the Harris administration? What policies would you recommend at that level in addition to these local efforts?
Yeah, obviously the book was written with an eye to continuance of the role of the federal government. And I went to some pains to identify for both infrastructural initiatives, housing and transport, what the role of the federal agency would be. And as it turns out, I mean, from the extent that I can, well, first of all, we know that obviously Trump's budget, in addition to wiping out climate-based initiatives is going to drastically hurt rural America. It's shifting costs to the states and local government. It devastates health care and reduces workforce. And also, I just read today, it's giving handouts to agribusinesses and mega farms and undercutting small farms. So that is the elephant in the room, of course, is how and with what resources these towns are going to help themselves. I would start by saying there are still funds. There's some money for Rural Energy for America, some obligated funds that are recently released, while the rest related to the IRA is frozen. Except investments in bio and renewable fuels. So I turn to the question of what is the role of corporate investment and philanthropic investment. And just looking around, I've found, for example, New York State has set aside $200 million for small town revitalization under the current administration. We have T-Mobile hosting hometown grants, and real estate, large corporations are also stepping in. But I also emphasize the role of the philanthropic sector, and I think change needs to be made in order to do that, because most foundations are underinvested in rural areas. They're urban-based. And we need to, have them dedicate funding to help create a roadmap for prospective receiver places where, my book sets out some ideas, but we need specific guidance documents in how to prepare, how to prepare both infrastructure and housing at the same time receiving climate migrants. And so, I want to say the book has examples of how towns initiated redevelopment without federal help, particularly in terms of replenishing their population and their school population. Many of created cash incentives to remote workers. We've seen like 40 or 50 towns and cities that have offered anywhere from, 5 to 10,000 to have people move in and either have a job already and work remotely or develop their own enterprise. Many European countries, of course, have already long been doing this. They're giving financial incentives to get people to leave the cities for the countryside and to boost populations and growth. So that's one thing that's going on in the background.
All right, that's more hopeful than I would have guessed. Dan, over to you.
Yeah, I was just hearing all these acronyms of all the federal agencies, and I keep sort of mentally crossing them out in my mind as if they don't exist anymore, which isn't quite the case, but the assumptions that would have to be based on their future existence in their current form would be, need to be severely altered. So how might you advise a municipality that wants to tackle these issues, but hasn't yet done so, or, had a sort of presumption that we're just going to be able to keep relying on FEMA and NOAA and USDA and all these other agencies that are, kind of the federal government's bulwarks against climate change?
In a sense, I think that they're going to start looking to state and local government. And by that, I mean, obviously, not every state government is going to pursue initiatives around climate mitigation. But some governors are standing up and saying, you know, we can forgo the federal emphasis on this and we can undertake it ourselves. The real question is that they're already being burdened by the prospect of Medicaid cuts. And so, you know, is there going to be sufficient finance available to small towns and cities? So it's a larger question. And again, I didn't really anticipate this in writing the book. How would I advise municipalities? Again, the emphasis is really on kind of looking at place-sensitive and local wealth-building strategies. I do stress the need for local activism and bottom-up leadership. And I think that for small towns, their best assets are often based in the social bonds and community connectedness. So to start with, that's what they've got going in their favor. And many of them also have untapped natural resources that they can look to. One town purchased an entire community forest. It became owned by the community. It was then forested. They undertook to create revenue from the trees they took down in a sustainable fashion. So that was a new revenue for them. Other small towns have really stepped up, and I'm talking about in really red states. One example in Missouri, where there's a lot of wind, they partnered with John Deere, the big manufacturer of farming equipment that got into the wind business. And together with local investors and John Deere, they created a wind farm there. And they are actually producing revenue from the surplus electricity after they serve the town. So, again, you know, stressing local resources, another town in Kansas, I believe, created a water park out of a dilapidated stream bed. And they have seen a plethora of new enterprises and restaurants and new businesses. So I think people are very entrepreneurial. We don't give them credit for that. And they're looking to see their way forward. However, I have to say that in the face of what Trump is doing to undermine rural life, I really fear for many of them.
And just to add to that, I'm going through the book copy as you're speaking of these instances. And for the record, the John Deere project was in Rockport, Missouri, population 1219. It's in northwestern Missouri near Nebraska. And I believe the town you were talking about with the forest initiatives were the two towns of Gorham and Milan, New Hampshire.
Yes, thank you for that correction. Yeah. In Missouri, it was the owner of a funeral business who got this idea in his head, and he approached John Deere. So, you know, it's common citizens who really understand the peril that they face in losing population and losing their economies.
Yeah, the picture that I develop is not quite as, let's say, extreme as that which is depicted in the zombie apocalypse series, The Last of Us. But it does kind of bring some of these ideas of rural resiliency to mind. It's kind of like people are getting the message that they're on their own, and increasingly that means look to your neighbors and rebuild your local communities and find a solution that works for you. And you know, that's going to have to maybe involve some changing attitudes, but it's also capitalizing on what's already there, which is kind of interesting. I think it's, we have no choice really, it seems, but to give some of these communities that have been overlooked credit for how resilient they are, and, you know, to trust them to overcome, let's say, the prejudices or the resistance to outsiders or the even outside help that, you know, I think are endemic to some of them. I mean, you know, this is an area of consideration that it probably is not crossing many people's minds, but some of these receiver counties are, you know, in places like Northern Idaho, which is kind of known as a hotbed of, you know, white nationalism. And that's going to be a big problem if they have new migrants. And in fact, the entire state of Michigan is identified as having receiver counties, which is great. But that is also a hotbed of white nationalism, which is probably going to become exacerbated by the conditions that this administration and prior administrations have set upon them, ironically. So, I mean, these are all kind of crazy scenarios that could be playing out in the next couple decades. But I do like that there's many, many notes of optimism that we can look to where local entrepreneurs have worked with industry and their local community to, you know, overcome those challenges. I'm hopeful that's going to be the majority story.
Yeah, let me give you one last closing example of a county in rural Iowa where the predominant business is cattle and meat packing, and they really had lost their employees over time. And they recognized that one way to create, to plug the hole was to lure immigrants. And so they looked to advertise and basically Latinx immigrants came. And the city underwent a very self-conscious effort to both adapt them and adapt themselves to these new newcomers. So in other words, they had to create a climate of receptivity, and they actually employed a consultant who did a number of workshops whereby the townspeople were given introductions to this different culture, and ultimately, it worked really well. So I look at the climigrants in the same through the same lens as perhaps some of the immigrants that have filled the lower strata of jobs in this country. And so we're ever hopeful that there is opportunity to make adjustments and to adapt the culture to welcome people.
Yeah, I'd love to follow up on that, Hillary. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. As a closing question in that regard is, and from a broader philosophical perspective, how do we not just prepare our environments but ourselves to understand this era of change? In the book, you very approvingly quote my good friend Parag Khanna's book, Move. I find Parag a fascinating figure in this regards to this discussion because Parag is very much an ecstatic nomad in his own mind. He celebrates the fact that humanity is about to be on the move because of these various crises, but that moving itself is not a bad thing, which I think most people look on this future landscape of climate migrants and manage retreat and see it as disastrous to those communities that are there, that people should in fact stay in place if possible, that we should try to save these places, or disastrous in the sense that people don't want migrants of any sort landing in their neighborhoods, a sort of xenophobic movement. How philosophically do you imagine this happening? How can we prepare ourselves to accept this future and that there is a silver lining, that there is hope to be found in bringing these communities in? Have you found any cases of this, of sort of people who went through that psychological shift, that Saul on the road to Tarsus moment when it comes to climate?
See, that's a really good question. And I do know that believe it was Syracuse, New York, received a number of immigrants across time. And what they found was that in the immigrant population, there was a lot of entrepreneurship. And it wasn't as though these people were looking for handouts. They were looking for opportunities to elevate themselves. And they were very creative. So how do we prepare ourselves? I mean, first of all, we have to be climate smart, and we're not very climate smart in this country. We know that whole sectors of the population simply discard, disbelieve, and denigrate the notion of climate change. I feel through researching the book, and I feel a sense of urgency for us to somehow cross this, heal the urban-rural divide in this country, which has really, decimated our democracy, to say the least. And so we need to have people understand that, understand the other half. I've been reading a lot of books about Red America, and understanding their humanity and understanding their plight, there's real opportunity for the rest of us to reverse our opinions and help these people help themselves. It's a perilous path, I think, to bring populations together. It has to be done with extreme care, but I think that there's so much promise as we cross the cultural divides and make our communities flourish again.
Thank you so much. This is Hillary Brown, author of Revitalize, Resettle: How Main Street USA Can Offer New Beginnings for America's Climate Displaced. This has been another episode of Unfrozen. Thank you.